Talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the history of ancient Rome, and we'll be finding out about life, death, power, and destruction in classical times. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just text us on 53106 and text costs 30 cents, or you can email us talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we looked at the life, legend, and legacy of Queen Victoria in this, the bicentenary year of her birth, and we discovered how she came to epitomise the Victorian era. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or go directly to iTunes. Tonight's show is a little bit different. We've brought together some of the leading classicists in Ireland, the United Kingdom and the United States to explore what life was like in ancient Rome. What can we learn by studying the architecture and literature of the period? What was life like for women? What was the role of slavery? How violent was everyday life? And what was the legacy of ancient Rome? Well, to help me answer these questions and more, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Claire Holleran lectures in classics and ancient history at the University of Exeter and is an expert on Roman social and economic history. And she's the author of Shopping in Ancient Rome, The Retail Trade in the Late Republic and the Principate. Dr. John Coulston is an archaeologist and historian at the University of St. Andrews and is an expert in Roman architecture, the Roman army and the city of Rome. And he's the author of All the Emperor's Men, Roman Soldiers and Barbarians on Trajan's Column. Professor Mary T. Boatwright is Professor of Classical Studies at Duke University in North Carolina, an expert on Roman history. She's President of the Society for Classical Studies, and her books include Peoples of the Roman World and A Brief History of the Romans. Dr. Alexandra Thane is the head of the School of Classics at UCD and is an expert on Roman Republican history and the topography of the city of Rome. And he's the co-editor of a new collection of essays, Sulla, Politics and Reception, to be published in November. Professor Monica Gale lectures in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin, an expert on the poetry of the late Roman Republican and the Augustan period and the use of myth in ancient literature. She's currently working on a commentary on the complete poems of Catullus for the Cambridge Greek and Latin classic series. Well, you're all very welcome. And Claire, I might start with you, and I might begin with a broad general question about what life was like in ancient Rome. What were the comings and goings? What were the sights, the sounds, the smells? What would people have experienced as regular daily goers in Rome? What was life like?
I think thinking about Rome, the first thing we need to remember is that this is a huge city. So by the Augustan period, so around the turn of the millennium, we're thinking of a population of about 1 million people, which might not sound that huge by modern standards, but that is massive in a pre-modern context. And it grows quite rapidly. So from about 200,000 in the 2nd century BC, we get this figure of 1 million within 200 years. And that's principally down to migration. So it's a city of migrants. Some of that is voluntary migration, and some of it is the enforced movement of people. So enslaved peoples being brought to the city. And people are coming from all over, really. So it's a very diverse city in terms of origins. It's a diverse city in terms of social status. So we've got really, really wealthy people, and we've got really, really poor people living side by side almost, because Rome's neighbourhoods aren't really differentiated by class or ethnicity or occupation. We're looking at neighbourhoods that really are socially stratified vertically almost. So people are living in these apartment blocks where you have wealthier residents on the ground floor and the first floor, and then poorer people living perhaps just renting a room or even a bed nightly. So we've also got a variety. Sorry.
So in terms of accommodation, it's a kind of a world that wouldn't be too unfamiliar to us.
No, I don't think so. So the very wealthy are living in private houses, but most people are living in these multiple occupancy blocks, which are essentially apartment blocks, with commercial units mainly on the ground floor. Sort of sometimes quite grand apartments on the first floor, and then, as I say, getting poorer as you move up the building. And probably around five stories is common. Some might be as high as eight stories. So Rome You know, it doesn't develop, it doesn't go outwards in the way that a modern city does. It goes upwards because land is expensive. They've got a really high population density in the city.
Very good. Alex, talk to us about the Mapping Augustan Rome project that you were involved in, because that gives us a sense of the built environment in ancient Rome.
It's one where all of the maps that exist before are basically from a particular period of time where everything is jumbled together. So you'd be looking at Rome in the time of the Emperor Constantine, and you'd see everything that existed up to that time. So we were focusing on a particular period, and the aim was to get a map of the Augustan period, which was a period of immense change, of new buildings coming along, of the urban image changing incredibly. And what we found was that when we peeled off the later buildings, what you end up with are these huge gaps. So if you look at the, you know, the areas outside of the forum, these were areas that were a real challenge to actually fill, to try and work out what was there in our period. And it was actually a lot of fun to actually delve into the details to actually reconstruct the city. But we basically figured out that, you know, you've got the monumental centre. We have a lot better impression of the built-up area of the city, the gardens that went around the built-up area of the city as well. And it was something where we were very conscious of trying to get Rome at a particular point in time rather than everything jumbled up together.
And it was like a jigsaw puzzle, but as you constructed the jigsaw, you found that you were getting a sense of how the city operated in terms of the aqueducts and the water towers and the pipes, and so you're getting a sense of how the city lived and breathed as well.
Definitely, very much. That's one of the things we need to think about. How do people actually survive? So water is incredibly important. Even just thinking about the aqueducts, it's not only the very monumental arches that you see on the outside of the city, but when you imagine what was like, what the city was like, and this is stuff that is long since gone, but we do have references to artworks, columns, monumentalization of the fountains, where ordinary people went out of their homes and got their daily water.
So if you were to go back to ancient Rome, what would the city have looked like in terms of parks and green spaces, or in terms of fountains that you're mentioning, monuments? How different would it look from the Rome of today?
In some ways, it's actually very similar to the Rome of today. So you do have the monumental centre, the places where we're all familiar with, the Forum, for example. If you sort of also imagine the residential areas, most of residential Rome at the moment is small streets, alleyways, brick buildings. That's sort of what we'd have to expect. But also, when you get a bit further out, the Villa Aurelia, the Villa Borghese, these are these big aristocratic parks that are very close to the centre, and some of them are actually in the same spot as parks which existed in the Augustan period and then also in later periods as well. So I would see actually quite a good continuity.
Monica, you get a sense from the literature that Rome was something special and that people felt they were living through something extraordinary. Was that how it would have been for the ordinary person?
Well, it's actually quite hard in some ways to get a sense from Latin literature of what life would have been like for, you know, the man in the forum, so to speak, in the sense that, of course, most of our authors were members of the upper classes, writing for other members of the upper classes. But there's one writer who I think does give a very vivid impression. It's maybe a slightly exaggerated impression, but a very vivid impression of how life would have been for the ordinary person. And that is the satirist Juvenal, who was probably a member of the upper classes himself, but creates this character Umbricius in his third satire, who he's a whinger. He moans about how awful life is in the city of Rome, but he also poses as a member of the lower classes, or Juvenal is speaking through him as a member of the lower classes. And I think what's so fascinating about this poem is that a lot of it sounds incredibly modern. So he complains about the traffic, he complains about immigration, which might strike a chord with things that have been in the news recently. But I wondered if I could just to quote a passage which kind of picks up your introduction, Patrick, where he's talking about the dangers of walking around in the city at night. So he writes, "Now let's consider all the other varied dangers at night. What a long way it is for a tile from the highest roof to fall on your head. How often a cracked and leaky pot plunges down from a sill. What a crash when they strike the pavement, chipping and cracking the stones. If you go out to dinner without making a will, you're thought of as simply careless, dismissive of those tragic events that occur. There are as many opportunities to die as there are open windows watching you when you go by at night. So I'd make a wretched wish and a prayer as you go that they'll rest content with simply emptying their brimming pots over you. The impudent drunk's annoyed if by chance there's no one at all to set upon, spending the whole night grieving like Achilles for his friend, lying now on his face and then turning onto his back, since it's the only way he can tire himself. It takes a brawl or two to send him to sleep. But however worked up he is, fired by youth and neat wine, he steers clear of him in the scarlet cloak, so he will get an impression of sort of class differences. He won't attack, the bully won't attack a member of the upper classes. Yet he despises me as I pass by the light of the moon as usual, or the flickering light of a candle, whose wick I take great care of and cautiously regulate. Take note of the setting awaiting a wretched fight, if you call it a fight, when one of us lashes out and the other one, me, takes a beating. And so he goes on. So he's describing here, you know, a city which is really, I mean, reminiscent of maybe the dodgier parts of London or Los Angeles to us. Again, a very modern sounding picture in some ways.
Mary, it's fascinating because it shows that there's this darker side to ancient Rome that perhaps is sometimes glossed over.
Are you speaking to me, Mary?
Oh, yes, Mary. Sorry. Yes, yeah. About that darker side, because there is this brutality, there's the violence, there's the way women and children are treated, and then there's the slave question. So it's a darker side that we sometimes don't get to see.
Yes, and I think we absolutely need to see it, because the great elites that we know of, even Juvenal had slaves and was supported by slaves, and the imperial women and the emperors themselves had legions of slaves who would be supporting them, doing everything for the women, from arranging their hair to taking care of their, what we might think of as their chamber pots, to folding their clothes nicely, to carrying their litters through the streets so that they wouldn't have to be seen by the normal populace on the street, and not to mention the agricultural slavery that supported the wealth of the Roman world. So, yes, we do have to see these aspects because it just isn't fair to understand the high points, if you will, of Rome without understanding the darker side and the oppression that allowed the wealthy to be wealthy and those who were in power to have the time and leisure, if you will, to make decisions.
Very good. Sorry, Mary, I think we have a problem with your line, so we might try and call you back on that. Claire, I might ask you about shopping in ancient Rome. What can we learn by studying shopping and the different types of commerce that you had, from the street stalls to more sophisticated enterprises?
Yeah, there was definitely a lively retail trade going on. I mean, supplying this city is a huge task. So we've got a really diverse retail trade. We've got markets, we've got shops and workshops in which goods tend to be both manufactured and sold. And as I was saying earlier, those apartment blocks often have commercial units on the ground floor. And there is a problem in Rome with a lot of them spreading out over their threshold. So we know from some of the legal sources, but also one of our writers, Marshall, who talks about how Rome is just one big shop, and it takes Domitian to enact legislation to say that shops have to stay within their threshold. It takes that to clear the streets so that you can get around. And to that, we've got to add street stalls, ambulant hawkers. Bars are a huge feature of the Roman streets. So if we think about people living in these apartment blocks, they may only have minimal cooking facilities. You know, they have access perhaps to running water in a fountain nearby, but not necessarily within their apartment blocks. They're cooking on a brazier in a small room. So it's not ideal. So a lot of the meals will have been taken in local bars. And they also sell food to take away. We know that you can take your own jug and fill it up with wine and take it back home from these bars. So they play a really important role in the retail trade. So it's a really thriving sector. And we do hear that a lot about the Chrysler street sellers as well. so Seneca, philosopher writing in the first century, he talks about living near a bathhouse. And alongside hearing the, you know, the grunts of people lifting weights and people having their hair plucked from their armpits and so on, one of the big noises is retailers. It's hawkers going around trying to sell food and drink to people within this bathhouse. So, you know, they're very active sellers of their wares.
Very good. And do we know exactly how much was being sold by the street vendors? Could you buy anything and everything?
Principally food appears most in our sources. I mean, when we're looking at this kind of thing, as Monica says, life lower down the social scale isn't always that easy to gauge. We're reliant on incidental or anecdotal references. So things like Seneca talking about the hawkers. But primarily, they do seem to reference street sellers selling food, the sorts of items that people need on an everyday basis. Just as you would imagine, you know, whenever you get a crowd of people, food is one of the big things that's sold. You know, they also go around to theatres and amphitheatres and so on selling food. Wherever you get a crowd, you get sellers of that type.
Very good. John, I want to bring you in about some of the monuments in ancient Rome, because I think they almost tell the story of the city through their history. And for example, Trajan's Column that you've done so much work on, that tells us a lot about the story of the city and the relationship of emperors to the people who live there.
Yes, you're quite right. There's a long tradition in the Republic of the elite taking on military commands and major administrative jobs in the provinces, and celebrating particularly their military victories through building triumphal temples. And this tradition goes on into the Principate period, when the emperors are the both the people who have cornered the military power, and they're also the uber patrons of the city. So putting up display monuments, whether those be great temples or more specifically linked to achievements in war, is very much something the emperors are involved in. And they accompany this with, obviously, there are the traditional triumphs, which only emperors now are able to enjoy, marching their troops through the streets with great painted placards depicting scenes of warfare from the war that's being celebrated, so the sack of Jerusalem or defeat of barbarians on the frontier or what have you. And that translates quite clearly into the sculpted, more permanent marble monuments, which from particularly the time of Domitian and Trajan are much more to do with contemporary representations of soldiers and barbarians, and linked very closely to triumphs and other benefactions that come out of the spoils of war.
And are these monuments a way of people showing their achievements to the people in Rome? Is it a form of self-promotion or propaganda, or is it done for the best interests of the people?
A lot of it's display, and I use that word very advisedly. I'd avoid the P word. Propaganda rather makes you think of Stalinist posters and heroic workers' statuary and things, partly because it's too easy to think about what the emperor is getting over as an individual personality, when with a lot of these monuments, we don't actually know what the agency is and who is working on the composition of those figural reliefs or messages. We can compare them with the coin issues, but again, we don't know exactly the mechanisms of designing what goes onto the coins, other than obviously the portraits of emperors, what messages on the reverses are being shown, and who's choosing them. So with the great sculptural monuments, yes, they're certainly representing a glorious achievement, and sometimes, as with Trajan's Column, very closely linked with the buildings and the complex that they nestle within, because the spoils of a specific war might overtly be being used to pay for something like the Great Forum of Trajan, biggest of all these great monumental complexes, which the gold from what's modern-day Romania went to pay for.
Very good. Claire, it's interesting when you look at some of the ambitious plans of some of the emperors, even looking at someone like Emperor Augustus, they very often weren't able to achieve all of their ambitions because other things interrupted their plans, and they had to take into account wars and politics and very often it thwarted their grand schemes.
Certainly for people like Caesar, that happened. Augustus was lucky in the sense that he was in power for over 40 years, and he was actually able to implement his building program. But his predecessor, Caesar, he was assassinated before he was able to bring his plans to fruition. So it was actually Augustus who finished a lot of Julius Caesar's projects, like his forum. But Augustus also built his own forum. He reorganized the Roman forum. He built the first public bathhouse in Rome, which was supplied by its own aqueduct. So he did all sorts of things in terms of building. I mean, he famously boasted himself that he found the city of brick and he left it in marble, which in some ways is actually true. Brick-faced buildings sort of dominated before Augustus. He was the first to use marble on a wide scale. But I think equally important for Augustus was that he not only looked to the built environment, but he also looked to the overall infrastructure of Rome. He had a more coherent overall plan for the city. I think before Augustus, building is episodic. Rome grows up fairly organically in a somewhat haphazard way. And actually, its public image is a bit of a joke in some ways before Augustus. I mean, Livy tells us that the Macedonian embassies that came in the 2nd century BC, they laughed at Rome because compared to the grand cities that they'd seen in the Greek world, it wasn't really much to look at. So it's Augustus who comes along and he overhauls the built environment, but also the infrastructure. He brings in important administrative reforms. So he reorganizes the city into 14 regions and they're each assigned to a particular magistrate. And they're then further subdivided into what we call vici, or neighbourhoods. And they each have their own local magistrate and their local centre of cult worship. And what Augustus is doing here really is trying to establish some control over that urban populace, because in the civil wars, there'd been widespread rioting in Rome. There's a lot of turbulence in the city. So this is a way of trying to establish some control and to bring in everybody into the Augustan city. And he also instituted a sort of fire service. So that numbered almost 4,000 men, recruited mainly from freed slaves. And they patrolled the city at night looking for fires, because fire is a huge problem in a city like Rome. So it's not just those big fires that we hear about, like the fire of 64 under Nero. Fires are frequent and commonplace, so they're a big danger. So by putting this group together, he's trying to tackle one of the big issues that Rome faces. And he also creates a series of offices looking at different aspects of administration. So the water supply, and there's gangs of slaves who take care of the maintenance of the aqueducts, the dredging of the Tiber, the grain supply, all these different aspects of life in the city. Augustus is able to come in and really try to overhaul the city as a whole. So he's really, really important in the history of the city.
And Claire, I know you can only join us for this first part, but in terms, you mentioned water there, in terms of things like disease, how safe was it for people living in it in terms of childbirth and general day-to-day life? Was the water safe to drink? Was it reasonable for people in their daily life?
Certainly, I think we kind of try and look at a balance sheet with Rome. So on the one hand, the amenities for a pre-modern city in Rome are really impressive. I think, as Alex was saying about the water supply, everybody would have access to fresh water pretty much. There would be a fountain nearby. If you didn't have it within your own house, which you would if you were wealthy, you certainly had access to fresh water. So that's a really important benefit of living in Rome. You also have access to bathhouses. I mean, it's really cheap to go and get clean in Rome. There's access to public toilets. So on the one hand, we can think of Rome in a really positive way. But on the other hand, those baths aren't necessarily always clean. Doctors advise that you go there if you've got all sorts of diseases that you perhaps wouldn't want to share the water with those people. We do have public toilets, but as Monica said, people are throwing the contents of their chamber pots out of their windows. And if Pompeii's anything to go by, we do have graffiti from Pompeii which say, in less polite terms, don't defecate outside my house. So if we had the same thing going on in Rome, you know, sanitation is not perhaps as good as we might immediately think. So Rome is a very grand city, and we think of it in that way, but actually it's also quite a dirty city. So disease is rife. And of course, with population density being so high, disease spreads very quickly as well. And in terms of childbirth and infant mortality, I mean, we probably have what we call a high fertility regime. So women are having lots of babies, but that's coupled with a high infant mortality rate. So I mean, perhaps the most famous example is Cornelia, who's the mother of the Gracchi. She's one of the really wealthy elites. She's the daughter of Scipio Africanus, who's the hero of the Second Punic War against Hannibal. And she famously had 12 children, and only three of those survived to adulthood. Now, that's an impressive number. Not everybody, by any stretch, is having 12 children. But if somebody among the wealthy elites can only have three that survive to adulthood, I think it gives us some sense of the levels of infant mortality in the city.
Okay.
Another reason why Rome is dependent on migration.
For that reason. Okay, well, Claire, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be continuing my discussion with my panel about the life and goings-on in ancient Rome.
This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. As we discuss what life was like in ancient Rome, I'm joined by Dr. John Coulston, Professor Mary Boatwright, Dr. Alexandra Thane, and Professor Monica Gale. And before the break, we were joined by Dr. Claire Holleran. Monica, can we... I've asked you about maybe poets who weren't... you had that wonderful reading from Juvenal, who had a more negative take. Did any of the poets have a positive view of life in Rome?
Yeah, in fact, on the whole, Roman literature tends to be a little bit sort of bipolar about the city of Rome, but I would say that on the whole, the kind of positive images outweigh the negative ones. So you find poets talking about, you know, golden Rome and eternal Rome, and this is the city that's crowned the seven hills with the head of the empire that's going to last forever and ever. Particularly in Augustan literature, there's a lot of celebration of the monuments, as Claire was talking about. Augustus boasted of having turned Rome from a city of brick into a city of marble. And the poets accordingly do give, in some cases, quite detailed descriptions even. And that can be indeed often our best way of knowing what some of these temples really looked like. So that sort of coexists with the passages like the passage I quoted from Juvenal, which give us a view of what we might call the seamier side of life in the city.
Alex, that's interesting when you talk about the temples, because you've done some interesting work on, say, for example, the Jupiter Optimus Maximus, and you get a good insight into the history and the story of the city from looking at a temple like that.
Yeah, that's a good one to pick, because we were just talking about Golden Rome, and this temple was one of the largest in the city. It's one that no longer exists, so it's not the sort of thing you're going to be able to actually visit and appreciate. But just to get a sense of scale, it's 60 by 50 metres, the grand plan. It was on one of the most important hills in Rome, just overlooking the Forum, and it had a golden roof. It had bronze roof tiles that were gilded. So whenever we're thinking about this golden Rome, this is the most golden temple in the city. And just to put it into perspective, one thing we know is that there was a colossal statue of Jupiter on the Capitoline that was also gilded, which was visible from the Alban Mount, which is a large mountain about 15 miles away from Rome, heading out towards Ciampino Airport, or further than Ciampino Airport. So this is the sort of thing we need to think about, the visual impact of something that seems quite ordinary, like gilded roof. Something that big is going to reflect for a long distance. But the temple we're talking about, I think it's important to think about centrality. It's dedicated to Jupiter, the most important deity. And if we think about how centrality works, it's about rituals. So just to give you one example, we had a mention of the triumph. The triumph finishes at this temple. There are other rituals. The consuls, the chief magistrates, they have to have a sacrifice at this temple on the 1st of January every year. And even stories about how the temple was built. They had this idea of, if you think about the word Capitolium, the Latin word in there is caput, which means head. And they thought of this as the head of the world, the centre of the world, the centre of Rome. Everything's tied together.
Very good. Mary, what was life like for women in ancient Rome? And were they particularly, were they visible? Did they have rights? Did they have a role? What was going on with women?
Good question. I mean, we have to think, when we're thinking about women in ancient Rome, we have to think about the very highly stratified society that was Rome, and that women who were at the lower end in terms of their economic status were also at the lower end in terms of their social and political status. And so we have that very clearly exemplified in the fact that someone whose job, if you will, was that of a barmaid had no legal rights, because she was seen in law as having the same status as prostitute and had no legal rights. On the other hand, if you're thinking about the people at the very top, I've been working on a book on imperial women of Rome. They had a lot of prestige. They also had access and the control of many, many resources. They did suffer from many of the same barriers to what we might think of as agency. Women could not serve in politics. They couldn't serve in the military. They could not go into court unless they were representing themselves. And even though we think about this as being enunciated in the Athenian Empire, it was best just for women to be quiet and to not be visible. So the most wealthy women, although one of the things that turned up in my research for my book was that we do see women working together in a way that might almost be political, when they are banding together to represent for somebody of their ilk, and they are coming together in a theater, the Theater of Pompey, for example, weeping together and saying, have pity for so-and-so. We do see that, but we just don't see much activity on their part. And that is something that happened, that incident is something that happens in the early Julio-Claudian period. And as time goes on, by the end of the first century CE and then the second century CE, we see women in public less and less, at least elite women in public less and less in the city of Rome. For the other women, of course, they had to be out. They were shopkeepers and street vendors, and they needed to live. But so there is this quite large divide that I can see when I'm thinking about women in ancient Rome.
And when you look at an area like marriage, at what age were women getting married?
Well, the elite women, so we're talking, when I use that term, I mean people who are of the senatorial class, which is maybe one half of 1% at most of the Roman world, and then maybe of the equestrian group, which is also very, very limited, maybe at most 2% of the entire Roman world, and this is done by monetary, by finance, by how much money, resources their families own, those people are usually getting married at the age of 13. The women in that group are getting married at the age of 13 to the age of maybe 15, often marrying somebody who was at the very least 10 years older than they were. And as we heard earlier, they are to have children. I mean, this was not only a kind of ideology of the Roman world, but I think that people embraced it. I mean, women, this was a major role for them. So to have children, have a family, was very important. But now we know very, very well how hard it is on a teenager to bear a child, how difficult it is for that young woman's bones and for her whole physical well-being. And so that contributes to the difficulties that we heard about before, about the high rates of infant mortality, and there were also, I think, pretty high rates of maternal mortality. So it's usually said we don't have as good evidence for people who are not at the very top echelons, but it's usually said that probably maybe 15 to 17 years old, we don't really know, would be the age at which young women lower in the socioeconomic groupings might be married. And in part, that probably has to do with something like menarche. It's like when a woman is considered to be legally available for marriage once she starts getting her menses. But if you are not well nourished, that comes later in your chronological life. So there may be something of that happening as well.
Very good. John, I get a sense when I look at some of the emphasis on public virtue that you see that represented in some of the private living spaces as well, that people are trying to project an image of themselves.
Yes. Monumentalization of private homes is something which is quite a feature of the later Republic. Wall paintings evincing public spaces, fora, things like that, sort of declines rather in the Augustan period as the realities of imperial rule perhaps are beginning to be more realized. I think one of the areas, though, that people are most concerned to monumentalize and to give a message of their achievements is through death, is through funerary mausolea, figural gravestones, monuments like this. About the only thing, perhaps, that the film Gladiator got right, film in 2000, was the idea that, you know, what you do in life echoes in eternity. And with a fairly vague idea of what happens to the spirit after death, then really your achievements, as defined by society, are something that lives after you. So this is one of the many reasons we have so many family mausolea and the other funerary monuments, a great range of these. Some of these provincial forms that are actually imported into Rome by the different constituent communities that come from the provinces. So soldiers particularly I've got in mind there. And it also helps us immensely because these people, whether they're private soldiers or senators, you know, rulers of the Roman world, or at least administrators of the Roman world, is that they supply a CV of their achievements in the funerary inscriptions, sometimes very formally, as you would recognize in a modern CV, with the various ranks they've achieved in the army, military decorations, etc., or the offices of state that members of the senatorial class have achieved through their careers.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be trying to assess the legacy of ancient Rome. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we discuss what life was like in ancient Rome. I'm joined by Dr. John Coulston, Professor Mary Boatwright, Dr. Alex Thane, and Professor Monica Gale. Monica, let's talk about satire and let's talk about love poetry. When we look at other kinds of writing, what sense do we get of life in ancient Rome?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, I quoted from Juvenal's satire, which tends, it's the kind of literature that tends to, you know, draw attention to the seamier side of life, as I said. Roman love poetry, though, is very interesting in the sense that it gives a real kind of sense of Rome both as a centre of culture and as a social centre. So Catullus, who is writing in the middle part of the first century BCE, mentions an awful lot of places in Rome where, you know, you might go to meet your girlfriend. We find the same kind of thing in Ovid, writing under Augustus. So we have a real sense of Rome as a sort of thriving centre of social life, but it's also absolutely the centre of culture, and poets from all over Italy, from all over the empire, really everyone ends up gravitating in Rome, into Rome.
John, one thing we haven't mentioned is the role of the army. And it's interesting when you look at the military presence in Rome, that must surely have an impact, the fact that there are so many soldiers there.
It does. Talking of juvenile satires, of course, the 16th unfinished satire, the last one, is all about somebody who gets beaten up by a soldier perhaps in a bar or whatever, and how inadvisable it is to walk out to the great fortress of the Praetorian Guard, which has been built by the Emperor Tiberius out on the northeast side of town, way beyond the boundaries of the city, so as not to look like a tyrant citadel, as it were. And this is one of a sort of crown of thorns, if you like, or a series of gems around the city, where accumulating over time, the military formations that are there to police the city, to protect the emperor, they increase over time. Just as you see in any 18th, 19th century city, if you think of Vienna with its series of caserme, or if you think of Dublin, Beggars Bush Barracks and Collins Barracks, etc., all those British Army installations which are instantly recognisable from their architecture and their building materials. Basically, this guy walks out, has to walk out to the castra of the Praetorians, and he is has to appeal to a court where the judge is a centurion and the jury is made up of fellow soldiers of the person who's beaten him up. And no witness is going to make the same journey to back him up. So Juvenal says, you know, how stupid of anybody to do this, having once been beaten up, then to get another set of the imprints of hobnails on their face, very vivid image of military brutality. So this is a sort of satirical exaggeration of military impact, pun intended on several levels, but that's what satire is about. But it has also to be based on an element of reality, and so soldiers are good to have around when they're disciplined and have strong officers, and very bad news to have around when they're indisciplined and they're allowed to run riot, as it were. And one of the qualities of the emperors that are being celebrated on the monuments on their behalf is disciplina, the whole idea that a good general, a good emperor, controls his low-status, armed, rather dangerous, very disturbing soldiers.
Very good. Mary, what do you see as the great legacy of ancient Rome? Is it the monuments, the built environment? Is it the political ideas? Is it the cultural dimension? What would you name as the legacy?
Well, it's interesting that we just heard that John used the word disciplina, the discipline, because that is one of the things that probably most people would say is one of the great legacies. And you can see it in the discipline of the armies, the discipline of command, the discipline of the workers who put together these fantastic buildings, including, I think, the infrastructure that we were hearing about before. It's not just a beautiful temple, but we also have roads being laid down and the like. I think, and another kind of discipline that comes in, I'm trying to make a connection with those who've spoken about literature, that one could say is a legacy of Rome, is the ability to make something new from the past, something that speaks to the modern world, and one might think about it as remixing. But it is something fresh and classical, if we want to use that term. For me, as a historian, the legacy is probably something that is not so well known as the aqueducts of Rome. And it is the political lesson that Polybius talks about when he says that Rome is one of the greatest governments ever to have arisen. And he's writing in the 2nd century BCE when Rome controls all the known world. And he says that Roman government comes from discipline that has been gained through troubles and problems, and the discipline has been forged in light of the disasters that Rome has endured. And for me, this is, we all live in hard times. We all experience troubles. But yet there's an optimism that we can learn from this and we'll forge ahead and learn from our experiences. And so there is the perseverance and discipline of the Romans that is, a positive legacy of their culture.
Alex, what would you see as the great legacy?
concrete. So I'll give you two buildings which would not exist without Roman concrete. So the first is the Pantheon and the second is the Colosseum. There are a couple of things that concrete allows you to do. You can build in much greater scale, and you can also do some interesting shapes. So domes, circles, all those sorts of things are things you can do with concrete. They're very good about hiding it. So what you would see would be the brickwork that faces the concrete. It's always hidden with marble. Sometimes you'd have fancy stone on the outside. So they're hiding the concrete, but it's the concrete that's allowing them to do some really interesting things with architecture.
Okay, Monica, I'm going to leave the final word on the legacy to you. Is it the literature?
For me, it would have to be Roman literature that's the great legacy, partly because it preserves many of the details about what life would have been like in ancient Rome that we've been talking about, partly because of the way that it flows into later European and even American literature through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, even up to our own day. And there's so much in Roman literature that still speaks to us, I think, even now. And that passage that I quoted from Juvenal is just one example amongst very many that I could have mentioned.
And Monica, do you think that's why it continues to inspire people? That we love looking back to ancient Rome, we're inspired, we love the movies, we love it as a phenomenon, because there is something recognisable but also somewhat elusive about it.
I think perhaps there is something in that, yes, that the Romans speak to us partly because the writers themselves, I suppose, were so concerned with defining their individuality and Rome's place in the world, but also because Rome, even to the Romans, was such a great symbol of power, and that's something that's always going to be at the centre of our thinking about all sorts of things.
So it's the power and the glory.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, on that note, we will end our discussion on ancient Rome. My thanks to my absolutely brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Claire Holleran, who was able to join us for the first part, Dr. John Coulston, Professor Mary Boatwright, Dr. Alexandra Thane and Professor Monica Gale. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we've got a very interesting one. We are going to be overturning everything you thought you knew about warfare, because we're going to be posing the question about whether battles really matter. And we'll be looking at lots more besides in our September book show. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.